WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacey Lynn. We begin in Gaza, where this man cried out when he saw one of dozens of Palestinians killed on their way to receive food at an aid center. CBS's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem.
It is still not clear exactly what happened in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip early Sunday. Witnesses said Israeli troops fired on crowds about half a mile away from the aid site hours before the distribution took place. The Israeli army issued a vague statement saying that they are unaware of injuries caused by Israeli troops within the distribution site and said the army is continuing to investigate.
Ukraine says it launched a large-scale drone attack on $7 billion worth of Russian military planes.
Drones attacking large strategic bombers parked on the tarmac. It was probably launched from inside Russia. Clearly, this is a very significant attack on the kinds of aircraft that Russia uses against targets across the country.
The BBC's Paul Adams reports that Russia also fired hundreds of drones into Ukraine in its biggest hit since the start of the war. Court rulings last week set off a legal battle over the president's tariffs. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick downplayed the legal uncertainty, telling Fox News Sunday,
"What's going to happen is we're going to take that up to higher courts. The president's going to win like he always does."
The Senate will get to work this week on President Trump's budget bill.
The bill combines President Trump's pledges to cut spending, extend tax cuts, and slash the federal deficit. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent tells CBS's Face the Nation he's confident this bill will pass Senate muster.
Everyone said that Speaker Johnson would not be able to get this bill out of the House with his slim majority. He got it out. Leader Thune has a bigger majority, and this is with President Trump's leadership.
Some Senate Republicans have raised a number of concerns about the bill. Still, Secretary Bessent believes both houses of Congress will eventually pass it. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, Washington.
The Atlantic hurricane season has officially begun. It runs from June 1st until November 30th. The most active month is typically September. NOAA predicts an above normal number of storms this year. Meteorologist Ana Torres Vasquez says that's because of
warmer than average ocean temperatures. And this was the case last year as well. You know, warm waters provide that fuel for these storms to really intensify and develop.
Forecasters predict between 13 to 19 named storms. 6 to 10 of those are expected to strengthen into hurricanes, and they say 3 to 5 could become major hurricanes. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Wisconsin is known for its drinking culture, and women are at higher risk of negative health impacts than men. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
Experts say alcohol impacts women differently than men, affecting every system in the body and potentially leading to hundreds of conditions, including cardiovascular diseases and some types of cancers. Dr. George Koob directs the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. He says women absorb and metabolize alcohol differently and tend to have a higher blood alcohol level than men after consumption because of body water distribution.
The pathology associated with alcohol is just generally worse in women than in men and progress more quickly. Everything from emergency department visits, hospitalization, liver transplants, and even deaths among women compared to men.
And are more likely to self-medicate with alcohol. Nearly 30% of Wisconsin adults binge drink at least once per month. Koob notes that in the past 50 years, the prevalence of drinking for women has caught up to men, and some evidence suggests that women progress more quickly in the stages of addiction to alcohol than men. He advises being aware of any family history of alcohol use disorder, since addiction can have genetic and environmental components.
Alcohol is a social lubricant. It's an intricate part of our society, but its toxicity is dose dependent. So the more you drink, the more of the problems there are.
Research shows even one drink per day can increase a woman's risk for breast cancer by up to 15%. Currently, the U.S. dietary guidelines for women are one drink in a 24-hour period. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Smoky skies overhead, mostly sunny, highs in the lower 80s, a developing southwest breeze of 5 to 10. Tonight, a few clouds around, temperatures dropping to the lower 60s. On Monday, mostly sunny, still smoky, highs in the upper 80s. Right now, it's 73.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, Dr. Kristen Lyerly on giving pharmacists greater ability to prescribe birth control pills. And we start a new feature wrapping up the weekend in sports.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9. This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and yes, my name is Jim Santel. I am your host here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted and honored that you have chosen to spend some of your weekend time with me and with my producer, Max. We're coming to you from the studios of Civic Media and Radio Park Racine. And as always, in our weekend broadcast, we are doing our weekly review of all things justice-related, government-related, rule of law promoting. And that includes lots of things pulled right from the headlines of just this past week. I'll tell you about our syllabus, our academic schedule in just a moment. Before that, want to remind you, as always, that you can be a part of and should be a part of our discussion by calling in to Max and to me. That phone number is 855-752-4842. One more time, that's 855-752-4842. You can also drop a comment, a question, an observation, your inquiry about anything on our syllabus into the Civic Media Dropbox. We will take a look at those, make those a part of discussion as well here on Amicus, a law review. Again, delighted, honored that you are part of our discussion this weekend as we launch in to some of the major decisions, major rule of law events and occurrences of just this past week. They fall under a number of big ticket items. That includes necessarily another revisiting of immigration issues. Yes, we talked last week about this major decision by the Supreme Court to permit the Trump administration to suspend the temporary protected status of about 350,000 Venezuelans. Well, it turns out the Supreme Court added once again late this past week, affecting now 500,000, half a million immigrants, rescinding, suspending a concept, a program, a plan put in place by the Biden administration, providing what's called humanitarian parole. We'll tell you about what that's all about. We'll talk a bit about the history, a lot about the history, understanding what that's about and why it is important, the significance of the Supreme Court's decision. Also, as we've talked before, a part of its emergency docket, this shadow docket, making decisions without explanations of what they're doing, some signed orders, some dissents. We'll get to those as well. All of that happening in the area of immigration just this past week. We also have breaking news throughout the week, including late in the week, having to do with academics, schooling, education in America and beyond. Yes, indeed, more events having to do with that war, that continuing battle between the president, the White House, and Harvard University. This time a judge in connection with this injunctive work that federal district court judges do routinely. A judge blocking Donald Trump's ban on international students. We'll tell you about who that judge is, what that judge has done. And at the same time, almost contemporaneous with that, an announcement coming from the Secretary of State. His name is Marco Rubio, saying that the government, the State Department, is going to, in his words, aggressively revoke the visas of Chinese students in this nation. We'll tell you about the categories that are going to be affected by that decision. Again, inside the academic area, lots of things having to do with the rule of law. We will talk necessarily. Yes, indeed, there's a connection between tariffs and yes, international economic issues and the rule of law. A major decision. Plural decisions coming out of different courts, federal courts, something called the United States Court of International Trade, initially suspending in major ways the capacity, the authority of this president to do what he's been doing, starting, stopping, reinitiating, halting various tariffs around the world. We'll tell you what the Court of International Trade did just this past week to upend much, if not all of that, and then a subsequent decision in the category of whipsawed by the federal courts and decisions that reverse and overturn lower court decisions. We'll talk about the Federal Circuit and what it did with that decision coming out of the United States Court of International Trade. All of that difficult, dizzying even to follow in the area of tariffs and the intersection of international economics, domestic economics, obviously prices, and monetary policy and the rule of law, justice, and government. We're also going to talk necessarily about, once again, these injunctions. Yes, indeed, that injunction having to do with Harvard, but also another injunction, a temporary restraining order entered by Judge Gallagher. We'll talk about her. We've talked about her before with respect to one particular immigrant who is almost certainly now still in El Salvador. What did she do, and how does that decision fall into a larger consideration of all of these judges? We'll talk, give you some inventory about what's going on generally when it comes to injunctive relief, these temporary restraining orders. Why is that important? Because, yes, indeed, it's also inside this so-called big, beautiful bill that has now passed the House of Representatives. You know that. I suspect that very few members of Congress, very few Americans have read the 1,000-page bill. But nestled inside that, a number of very concerning, hugely dramatic changes in the way that America works and operates. Among those, a provision that would tie the hands of federal district court judges when it comes to reviewing the applications for these injunctive orders and then entering them, having them enforced. We'll talk about what a bond is, why that's so very important under a rule of civil procedure. We'll talk about what that big, beautiful bill would remove from the capacity of federal judges to do when it comes to reviewing, at least preliminarily, the merits of these many executive orders. Now somewhere approaching about 170 altogether, probably well in excess of 250 lawsuits. We'll do some inventory of that as well. We'll talk once again about necessarily those Venezuelan immigrants taken to El Salvador. We'll talk about the entire corpus of cases involving injunctive relief sought in front of the federal district courts. And again, the involvement of our legislature now in restricting potentially, possibly, the capacity of your federal judges to do just that. That is to review cases and determine whether or not, at least preliminarily, they should go ahead, whether the merits of them are sufficiently strong to justify a temporary restraining order or not. The United States Senate now has in its lap, in its inbox, this major piece of legislation that includes this provision having to do with injunctions. We'll talk about all of that in connection with our returning series, our returning segment always called Injunction Function, the function of federal courts. since time began in this nation, since time began under our Constitution to do these kinds of things. Now the federal legislature attempting, for obvious reasons, to stop that from happening in a major way. But we begin necessarily, as we sometimes do on Amicus Law Review, by talking as a friend of the community, talking about the amicus, the information that is provided to you in that sense of amicus, friend of the community, friend to all of our listeners, about something else that's going on outside of our borders. We have chatted about this before on Amicus Law Review. We're going to revisit it again this weekend, beginning right now. It has to do with Mexico and the fact that for the first time this weekend, this Sunday, this weekend, Mexicans, the citizens of Mexico, just to our south, are going to vote for thousands of candidates on the ballot to fill about 2,600 positions in federal, state, and local courts. A daunting task before the Mexican citizenry right now. For the first time in the country's history, the Mexican citizenry is going to be electing more than 2,600 judges, also including magistrates. Some of those are going to be sitting on the Supreme Court of the nation, hundreds of other federal, state, and local tribunals. It is a major revision, a major recrafting, a recreation of the very judiciary, the system there in Mexico. The move to this non-appointed but elective system is one in which voters themselves will choose their judges. Again, you know, here in America, in the United States, what do? We've got a bifurcated system for the most part. Federal judges, they are appointed, and that's the way that Mexico used to do things up until this week and the coming weeks. But there are also state court judges, including right here in Wisconsin, the great majority of them. There are some provisions for a governor to appoint some of them on an interim basis. But in the state systems, we do, in fact, elect our judges, a subject of an awful lot of debate out there about which one is better. What are the merits and demerits of having appointed judges as opposed to elective judges? That also a part of the legislative review of this entire system in Mexico in recent times. Supporters of this overhaul argue that it makes the system, the judicial system, of course, more democratic. It counteracts huge problems that undeniably exist there in Mexico, like nepotism and especially corruption in the judiciary there. Critics of this new plan to have judges elected as opposed to appointed there in Mexico are saying with equally strong voices that it risks giving the governing party, and that's where it came from, that's where this legislative change came from, gives the governing party more power, opens the candidates who lack experience and qualifications to being subject to the whims of the electorate. If you make decisions that are not popular, it may well be that you'll be voted out. We want that as a part of a system. That's what they argue. Could be influenced by various groups, including criminal groups, political groups, all kinds of things when you move from an appointed system to an elective system. That decision has been made by the Mexican government and by the people of Mexico. The experiment is so ambitious. It is also, as I just indicated, so very divisive among the Mexican population. It is also admittedly confusing, as the president of Mexico has indicated. Difficult to know exactly how it will unfold. A single day of voting that happens Sunday this weekend will enact what is certainly the most far-reaching judicial overhaul ever by a contemporary large democracy. Let me say that again. It's the most far-reaching judicial overhaul by any large democracy in our contemporary times. This is no small thing. So what do we need to know about all this? First of all, where did it come from and what happened exactly? Well, we know that in the past, there have been these allegations, again, that the appointed judges were corrupt, that their staffs and maybe even the judges themselves appointed as a result of nepotism. Culmination of a very contentious process in which Morena, which is the governing party, and its allies, because of their concerns about appointed judges, amended the Constitution last year. We talked about this at the time that it's happened and basically overhauled the court system. That's what happened in the recent history. The idea to elect judges by popular vote was proposed by the former president. His name is Manuel Lopez Obrador. And it was championed by the present president. Her name is Claudia Sheinbaum. We have talked a lot about her as well, including at the time that she was elected first female president of that nation, something that America has yet to do. Claudia Sheinbaum, you also may know, very, very famous, notorious even recently, because of her trolling of our president, who has renamed, arguably renamed, the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf of America. Claudia Sheinbaum taking exception to many of the things that our president has done. We'll talk about what Claudia Sheinbaum and her party and the party of her successor have done, changing the way that judges in Mexico are selected now by the people, as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
Matt and Air on Air.
Congressman Mark Pocan is here. Are you planning on going out on the road again, having a couple more town halls?
Yes. No, Claire. Derek and I have been invited by Opportunity Wisconsin, so I'm really looking forward to debating Derek. My guess is it's more likely I will sprout a head full of hair than he will show up. This is important to let people know what's in this bill, because there is a very good reason why Republicans are hiding from town halls.
Catch Matt and Air on Air at its new time, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Matt Miller, Milwaukee-based film critic. The film Sinners, the more distance I have from it, the more I liked it. Is that an Oscar film?
I think there is a love for what Sinners is doing, that a studio movie was this interesting and creative and thoughtful, but also entertaining. This is not the last you will hear about Sinners this year. I'd be shocked if it doesn't get a Best Picture nomination.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Did you know? VA home loans are a key to home ownership for those who served.
In the military, we make a lot of sacrifices, and with the VA loan, it makes it easier for us to get a home.
We were able to purchase this home and then use the money that we were going to use as a down to actually fix up the home. I would tell anybody who is interested in getting a VA loan to just do it.
To learn more about VA home loans, visit va.gov/homeloans.
The Elder Care Locator is here to help you live your best life as you age at home. Our call center advisors are ready to connect you with trustworthy local experts. Help is just a phone call away at 1-800-677-1116.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Your local Civic Media radio station is your source for real news and great conversation, plus fun and exciting contests. For a complete list of contest rules, log on to tap.fm/contest-terms. As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well. As always, taking your comments, your questions, your inquiries, your observations at that Civic Media number. That is 855-752-4842. Be a part of our discussion this weekend as we consider a great number of issues in the area of immigration and academics and international tariff issues, injunctions, and yes, beginning our 2 hours together by talking about something significant having to do with our neighbor to the south. It is Mexico. Is it relevant to understanding what's going on in America? Sure it is. Of course it is, because the civics lesson here is that decisions about how we elect judges, those are made by the people. Those are made by the people. And again, in our Constitution, almost 250 years ago, the decision made advocated for by people like Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and John Jay as well. All of those folks advocating and securing the notion that in the federal system, we appoint judges. The president nominates, the Senate confirms, if at all. That's the appointed process in many, if not all, of the states. In the United States, the opposite is true. We vote for our judges, merits and demerits to both sides of that operational approach. And the answer is, of course, that it's the people who decide how to do that. In Mexico, they had a constitution that used to prescribe exactly what we have, which is appointed judges. And what happened was that the former president, his name once again, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, pushed a plan after the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court there in Mexico, issued a series of rulings that blocked some of his major initiatives, didn't like what the Supreme Court is doing there. Does that sound familiar? It should. And among other things, according to the former president, those decisions by the Mexican Supreme Court weakened the electoral watchdog agency, put the National Guard under military control, all kinds of things that the president did not like. And after federal judges issued orders to suspend some of the former president's basic flagship projects, including some environmental concerns, the president went to the Congress and said, we need to change this. We can't go ahead with continuing appointed judges. Let's change the Constitution. And yes, they did. They went to the people, and the people of Mexico spoke, not without great controversy, not without great objection, And the people of Mexico, by a vote, changed their constitution, something that we could do if indeed there is enough of support in America to do this. If indeed that's what Americans want to do, Mexicans did it. And as a result of what they did last fall, now we're seeing the effect of that, specifically in the wake of what the president called these politically motivated decisions by courts across the country. He urged the population to support the control of the judges in the hands of the people. No small thing. Large majorities secured by the party during last year's general election allowed its lawmakers to pass these constitutional changes that overhauled the system. Once again, the single biggest, largest, most significant contemporary change ever by a contemporary democracy, a Western, a free and fair democracy in our lifetime. So what happened? So Sunday of this weekend, voters will elect now one half of Mexico's judiciary, the rest in a couple years, in 2027. That's how this system is being put into place. This year alone, in the following hours, nearly 880 federal judgeships, from district judges up to the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, will be up for grabs. And the people of Mexico will decide who those people are. 19 of the country's 32 states will elect local judges and magistrates to fill about 1,800 seats. That's going on in Mexico this weekend. More than 7,700 candidates are running for those jobs. 77 people on the ballots this weekend for those judicial positions. And unlike the regular elections, where political parties can finance their candidates' campaigns and do other things, pouring a lot of money into these campaigns. Again, does that sound familiar? Absolutely. Absolutely. Here in the state of Wisconsin, other states around the country, aspiring judges in Mexico are not allowed to rely on public or private funding. Either one of those. Can't get monies from either one of those sources, public or private. And what does it do? Of course, it forced them to instead use their own resources. Yes, indeed, if you are still economically able to do so, you can fund a lot. But also requiring them to depend an awful lot more on things like social media, visits to specific communities, town hall meetings, going door to door, the kinds of grassroots campaigning that we still see here in Wisconsin and other places around the country, but forcing them not to do that with the support of public or private monies. And so interesting to try to help voters along the way. The agency overseeing this vote now, the government agency responsible for administering how this is going to happen, created an online platform so that Mexican voters, people can familiarize themselves with the candidates. You go online, you pull up a name, you pull up a great number of people, you read about who they are, what they stand for, whether they are in favor of the fair and equitable disposition of justice. How do they describe themselves? Are they so-called activist judges? Are they judges who apply the law to the facts? Do they follow the rule of law? All those kinds of things that animate our discussions. Still, even with all of that, some supporters of the overhaul acknowledge that it'll be difficult for voters to make those informed choices among thousands of what are admittedly very much unknown candidates. A recent poll mentioned by President Sheinbaum, the present president, during one of her news conferences, she said that 72% of about 1,000 voters surveyed said the judicial elections were needed. So you've got huge support for doing it this way, the new mechanism there in Mexico. But only a small fraction of them, she reported, 23%, knew who the candidates were. About 23% going into this election now happening hours from now, this weekend in Mexico. When we come back, we'll tell you a little bit more about that, when we're going to hear the results of that. And then we will come back to the United States and talk about immigration and academics and tariffs. All of that coming up on Amicus, a law review.
93.5 The Tap. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. An attack near an aid distribution center in the Gaza Strip killed dozens. Cindy McCain with the United Nations World Food Program told ABC's This Week.
It's a tragedy, and what we need right now is an immediate ceasefire, complete unfettered access, along with the safe fence roads, every gate open to feed people and stop this catastrophe from happening.
Ukrainian drones were able to get deep into Russia, striking more than 40 military planes.
Small drones were transported to Russia before being launched remotely. The 18-month operation was overseen by President Zelensky.
Senator Rand Paul told Face the Nation he won't vote for the president's budget bill like it is right now because he says it would increase government spending in 1 year by more than $320 billion.
To put that in perspective, that's more than all the DOGE cuts that we found so far. So the increase in spending put into this bill exceeds the DOGE cuts.
CBS News Brief. I'm Stacey Lynn.
Revenge for Rhys Hoskins. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers and the Phillies wrap up their series today at Citizens Bank Park. A full recap this evening. Yesterday, the Brewers' Rhys Hoskins with a pair of three-run homers against his former team, the Phillies, leading Milwaukee to a 17-7 win in Philadelphia. The Brewers knocked the Phillies starter, Jesus Luzardo, out of the game by early in the fourth inning. Manager Pat Murphy after the win.
I mean, he's got great stuff. He's a guy that we would love to have. Anybody in baseball would love to have him. He's one of the great ones in the game. His stuff is tremendous. We did have a good plan against them, and we executed. And we're playing with a lot more freedom, and that freedom creates some special things. So we put it all together.
NBA, the Indiana Pacers, the team that ended the Bucks season early in the playoffs, are headed to the finals. They knocked out the Knicks 125-108 last night in Indy to take the Eastern Conference Championship 4-2. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Major Margaret Houlihan, also known as actress Loretta Swit, has passed away. Swift played the character, also known as Hot Lips, for the entire 11-year run of MASH. According to Deadline, she was nominated for an Emmy Award every year and won twice in 1980 and 1982. Swit passed away at her New York home from natural causes last Friday at the age of 87. Hot Lips and Frank, together again. More troubling news regarding Kevin Costner's too-long-to-say movie title and ridiculously long movie, also known as Horizon, An American Saga, Parts 1 and 2. Good grief. Last week, Costner was accused by a stunt person of sexual harassment, and now the production is being accused of not paying its costume fees. The United Costume Corporation is seeking $350,000 for unpaid fees, according to Variety. Just a word to the wise, to the Yellowstone star, those costumes may come in handy if creditors come knocking. For more showbiz fun, tune into Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Smoky skies overhead, mostly sunny, highs in the lower 80s, a developing southwest breeze of 5 to 10. Tonight, a few clouds around, temperatures dropping to the lower 60s. On Monday, mostly sunny, still smoky, highs in the upper 80s. It's 75 at our studios.
It's June Dairy Month, and though more than 5 million people call Wisconsin home, we share our state with close to 1.5 million cows. Those beautiful animals. Okay, I grew up on a dairy farm outside of Green Bay. They've been here since before we became a state. Can you answer this? Most of our cow's milk currently makes which product? Is it butter, cheese, or ice cream? The answer coming up. Wisconsin's first official milk plant. 1894 in the Waupun area of Fond du Lac County. Fast forward more than 120 years, now farmer-owned with a second location in the Outagamie County village of Black Creek, the Saputo plant is even featured on History Channel's Modern Marvels for its award-winning cheesemaking. So did you guess? Most of our cow's milk, 90% of it currently makes cheese. Gouda for you. Celebrating our dairy farmers with this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Maggie Dawn.
At 4:30, I'll be joined by senior ranking member of the state's Joint Finance Committee, Senator LaTanya Jackson, to talk about the Republicans' cuts that will affect you and yours.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, beginning our discussion this weekend about this more than significant change in the way that Mexicans, the country of Mexico, identifies and selects its judiciary across the board. This weekend, a change being made unlike any other in contemporary democracies on the face of the planet. Mexico going from an appointive system, which we have with respect to the federal judges, to an elective system, which we have with respect to most situations involving our state court judges. Again, on Sunday, this weekend, voters in Mexico electing half of the judiciary. 7,700 candidates running for these positions, 880 federal judgeships, 1,800 other seats in the counties and local entities, judges, magistrates across the board. All of this coming in the wake of last year's decision by the people of Mexico to change their constitution. Again, encouraged by former President López Obrador, very much embraced by President Claudia Sheinbaum. She has recently commented that while she supports this, she also knows that there's got to be an awful lot of education going on. She noted that in a recent poll, about 72% of the 1,000 voters surveyed said they did in fact support this notion, but only a very small fraction of those actually know who the candidates are, requiring them, yes, to go online to take a look at what these candidates stand for, requiring the Mexican residents and citizens to take a look at who these candidates are as they go door to door, as they convene in town halls. It requires an awful lot of specific, particularized engagement with the judiciary. That surely is a good thing. And the other big thing that this accomplishes, again, based upon the constitutional changes made by the Mexican population, is that money is out of this. You can support your campaign a bit independently yourself, but unlike our nation, where again, Citizen United, that Supreme Court case of many years ago now, that basically said that indeed it is a First Amendment issue to be able to support candidacies. The money that floods into, yes, even our judicial races, as you all know well, in state systems and in local systems, the support of electing judges through monetary contributions, that they don't have anymore in Mexico. And so the people are going to the polls this weekend to figure all this out. So once again, when do we know the results? Well, and paper ballots. The Constitution requires there that there be paper ballots. We have that here, certainly in the state of Wisconsin and in other states. In our system, of course, our Constitution, our federal system says that the terms and circumstances, the trappings of elections, what are they left to? They're left to the states, right? And that's why all these decisions about how elections are conducted are matters for state election commissions, including right here in Wisconsin, to be decided by them, certainly to be reviewed if there are challenges to them by state courts, but their decisions made by states and not by the federal government. Under the Mexican regime now, the structure for this new voting system, all of those paper ballots have to be counted by hand, have to do it by hand. And unlike other Mexican elections, when preliminary results are known typically on election night, because of that, the results for at least the federal judiciary, the judges who are in the Supreme Court and the other federal judges in Mexico, those will become clear in days, maybe later this week, maybe even down the road. The nationwide vote counts will determine the final results, again, will take place on June 15th. So it's going to be a while before we know the results of all this. No small controversy, even as Mexicans go to the polls this weekend, subject of an awful lot of debate before the Constitution was changed. Renewed debate right now in Mexico to our south. Again, supporters of the election talk about a system that is rife with corruption and nepotism when judges were appointed. Justice was more easily accessible to those who could afford it, could engage in bribery and corruption, and dozens of judges being co-opted by one or more of Mexico's violent cartels. That was the allegation when you had appointed judges, subject not to review by the people, but rather by the results of corruption and payments. In fact, Mexicans perceive judges, according to polling, to be among the country's most corrupt officials. Judges, the most corrupt officials, second only to traffic agents. That fueled plainly an awful lot of the movement now completed, now being put into effect to change the way that judges are selected in Mexico. A system in which judges are elected, proponents say, will sever those ties that some have had with these powerful criminals there, corrupt officials, and members of an elite portion of the citizenry. They argue that judges will now respond to the interests of those who voted for them. Who are those people? Those are the Mexican citizens, the people themselves choosing who it is who's going to take their places on the benches of justice around the nation. Critics concede that Mexico's judiciary faces huge problems. Absolutely, those are known, in need of deep reform, but they say this is not the way to do it. Don't fix it this way. Well, that decision has now been made. Several on that side of the argument have argued that the overall will politicize courts, make the individual judges who are running for these positions more political, and they will no longer be able to hand down justice independently, not being concerned about how the local citizenry, the nationwide citizenry, views their decisions, that the governing Morena Party, which already holds the presidency and the Congress, will now wield some extraordinary influence over this vote. That's the concern about the system now in place. They've also said that a system of direct elections risks letting underqualified candidates, people throwing their names onto the ballot, becoming judges and opening the door to greater cartel influence, inexperience, lack of sophistication on the bench, all those kinds of things coming from an elective system. They basically track those arguments, the kinds of things that James Madison in particular addressed in the Federalist Papers, advocating for the federal system of having judges appointed. Again, on the opposite side, state judges for the most part, selected by the people. Take a look at the Federalist Papers. You'll see the very argument that's been going on in Mexico in this century, just last year, being repeated in the Federalist Papers a couple of hundred years ago by our founding fathers. The issues don't go away. It is a great civics issue. It is a great learning issue for all of us to understand that there are decisions to make here and that one set of approaches, one set of structures to select judges has its merits and demerits, as does the other side as well. Mexico now going in the direction of judicial elections, voting for thousands of candidates to fill more than 2,600 positions in federal, state, and local courts. That happening just to our south in Mexico. Let's come back to the United States of America and talk about our Supreme Court and something significant that it did in connection with immigration, migration, and these continuing issues coming out of the president's serial executive orders and, yes, serial challenges to them, decisions and actions undertaken by Kristi Noem and the Department of Homeland Security, by our Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and others to deport large numbers of people ever since the president became our chief executive. Questions about the authority to do that, the mechanisms, the statutory basis for doing that. We've talked a lot about the Alien Enemies Act invoked by the president and by those who support doing this over the many months of these deportations. All of that subject to review by the courts, whether or not that is a proper basis upon which to do it. We talked just last week about the decision of the Supreme Court, basically once again on its shadow docket, its emergency docket. What is that? Once again, running to the Supreme Court before the litigation, the underlying litigation is done, before the challenge to it has been heard by a court, by a jury, adjudicated to judgment, running to the Supreme Court and saying you must stop something from happening at the lower courts. And that something almost universally, unanimously has been to stop the executive orders of this president. The executive branch, the Solicitor General, running to the Supreme Court a week or so ago and saying, with respect to about 350 Venezuelans, that something called the temporary protected status could no longer exist, established again by virtue of the Congress invoked by President Biden to protect 350,000 Venezuelans. We talked about that decision by the Supreme Court while this underlying litigation is going on. The decision by the Supreme Court to allow the administration to go ahead to begin to deport any of those 350,000 Venezuelans. That was last week. It has happened again this week. This time the number is even much greater. Supreme Court now allowing the Trump administration again as a part of its shadow docket. What does that mean? Once again, we are not getting the benefit of briefing. Lawyers coming before the Supreme Court and providing them with great detail about the reasons why these things should or should not happen. We're losing the capacity in oral argument, which we talk about routinely on this broadcast and others of civic media, where we can hear the arguments. Even if you don't want to read through all of the lawyer stuff in all those documents, you can hear what the justices are concerned about. You can hear the merits of these cases being argued. That's what you miss. That's the transparency in the shadow docket. And perhaps most importantly, you do not get the expositions that, yes, indeed, sometimes tens of pages, often hundreds of pages of documents, of writings by our Supreme Court members explaining what they're doing. Transparency from our judiciary. That's the problem with the shadow docket. And indeed, it happened again this past week. An unsigned order, unsigned, providing no reasoning. And again, that's typical when, in fact, the justices rule on these emergency applications, running to the court and saying you've got to do something right now. The Supreme Court, this time, as late as Friday of this past week, allowing the Trump administration, for now at least, for now, even while the litigation goes on, to revoke, to stop, to reverse a Biden era, humanitarian program. And that program was intended to give temporary residence to more than, 500,000 immigrants, 500,000 people in this country right now from countries that are facing war and political turmoil. Now, even though the order, again, affecting 500,000 immigrants, 500,000 people in this country right now, even though that order unsigned, we don't know exactly the reasons for it. We know that a majority of the Supreme Court said, yes, indeed, Mr. President, you can go ahead with your deportations of these individuals, even while the underlying claims have not yet been adjudicated to judgment. We know that there were some dissents. Ketanji Brown Jackson, Associate Justice, joined by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, dissented. She said, the majority has not given enough consideration, this is her quote, to the devastating consequences of allowing the government to precipitously upend the lives and the livelihoods of nearly half a million non-citizens while their legal claims to stay here are pending. Wow. The ruling exposes migrants from Cuba and Nicaragua and Venezuela and Haiti to possible deportation. It is undeniably the latest in this series of emergency orders by the justices in recent weeks. Last week, again, 350,000 Venezuelans. This week, 500,000 immigrants. A flurry of these applications coming in. Now, the two bases upon which these two decisions have been based are different. Humanitarian parole, which is the basis upon
local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Summer. It's time for Civic Media's Scotty Summer Text to Win contest right here on this local Civic Media radio station. We want to hook you up with $100 cash, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, and the chance to win a summer getaway to the Wisconsin Dells area or an escape to Door County. Download the free Civic Media app in the Google Play or App Store and get ready to text in for your first chance to win in this statewide contest starting Monday, June 2nd at 7 a.m. It's Civic Media's Scotty Summer.
Medicare loses about $60 billion annually to fraud, errors, and abuse. June 2nd through the 8th is Medicare Fraud Prevention Week, focusing on the actions everyone can take to prevent, detect, and report Medicare fraud. Learn more by liking and following Wisconsin Senior Medicare Patrol on Facebook. Then visit our website, smpwi.org. For information and advice, remember, Wisconsin Senior Medicare Patrol.
All across Wisconsin, destination marketing organizations are working to ensure that tourism in our state and your local community is stronger than ever. Because when you travel in Wisconsin, you see what our beautiful state has to offer. And now, more than ever, you see the importance of the travel and tourism industry and the impact it has on our community's small businesses, infrastructure, and economy. Destination marketing organizations statewide are working diligently to generate the economic benefits tourism has to offer and ensure that tourism in Wisconsin recovers better than ever. Their work to drive visitation, book meetings and conventions, and enhance the visitor experience not only encourages travelers to discover Wisconsin, it bolsters the economy, supports jobs, and it improves the quality of life for all Wisconsin residents. And you can do your part just by exploring Wisconsin yourselves or supporting your local destination marketing organization directly. To learn more about what Wisconsin's destination marketing organizations are doing, visit destinationswisconsin.com. Sponsored by Destinations Wisconsin.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. We are in a rare moment right now in Wisconsin politics. Why, you ask? Well, it's because we are not actively in the middle of a campaign cycle. It's been more than 6 weeks now since any of us have seen a campaign ad. It's been pretty nice, hasn't it? The moment we're in is as close as we're going to get to a political off-season here in Wisconsin. And we need to take advantage of this moment by taking action to improve our democracy. That means taking steps to address money in politics, cleaning up some issues with election administration, and creating a long-term plan for nonpartisan redistricting. In some cases, we can't make these kinds of changes in the middle of a campaign, so we need to be thinking about what we can do now. There's a lot both parties can agree on here, too. So let's make some moves this offseason, Wisconsin. Seize this moment to make a better, stronger, more inclusive democracy.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. On this weekend broadcast, we're spending appropriately some time talking about this latest decision of your United States Supreme Court. Unsigned order No analysis, no exposition of the reasons for their doing this. We've got some dissenting justices who talk about the failure of the court to address this in a way that is balanced and an understanding of the true merits of this, precipitously making a decision here, according to Ketanji Brown Jackson. But nonetheless, saying that the Trump administration can now proceed to deport about 500,000 people in this country, previously protected under a humanitarian parole program. Let's talk about what that means. This is not a program cooked up by the Biden administration overnight to keep people protected. It's been around for decades. Used to admit nearly 200,000 Cubans during the 1960s, more than 350,000 Southeast Asians after the fall of Saigon during the Vietnam War. Again, situations where individuals apply again on a case-by-case basis when there is concern about their own countries of origin facing war, political turmoil, making the applications. Presidents on both sides of the political aisle have invoked this concept, this program in the past to protect people in that category. It is a humanitarian parole program described that way because it's humanitarian. The Biden administration announced a humanitarian parole program as a part of this decades-long tradition by all administrations in April of 2022 for what group of people? Ukrainians. Ukrainians fleeing after the Russian invasion there. They have been protected under this humanitarian parole program. Biden officials then introduced the program for Venezuelans in late 2022, and yes, indeed, for Cubans and Haitians and Nicaraguans in January of 23. Again, all of them making specific, particularized applications based upon the problems back in their countries of origin. With a stalemate in Congress over immigration, we have seen that before, the incapacity apparently of our Congress to pass any omnibus legislation that would address these things. Therefore, you've got a president who's doing what the Congress does not. It has vacated the field. Criticism on both sides of the political aisle about that. A sharp increase in border crossings. The programs then by President Biden cleared the way for hundreds of thousands of immigrants from those nations to enter the country legally. Biden officials had hoped, of course, that programs would encourage immigrants to fly, to take to the air, the United States, come here, and apply for entry in an organized fashion. Let's provide some structure to all of this. Rather than traveling by foot, coming north into this country, crossing the border illegally, those images that are bandied about on the media. Fly in, make this routinized, make this regular, and we can apply this humanitarian principle to you in that organized way. When the program was adopted for the Venezuelans, official ports of entry had been closed to migrants since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, and that produced additional incentive for those intent on reaching the country to take more dangerous routes, we know that well, to cross the border illegally. And no one wants that, right? And so after the administration introduced its policy, Border Patrol apprehensions of migrants at the border from those countries actually dropped. They dropped sharply as a result of the Biden administration and its humanitarian parole problem. The policy, rather, that it put in place addressing this problem. Texas and some other states filed lawsuits during the Biden administration seeking to block the parole program, arguing that it burdened them by adding the costs for health care and education, law enforcement. The courts routinely upheld the legality of that program. President Trump, again, when he came into office, moved to end this program, humanitarian parole, for people from Cuba and Nicaragua and Venezuela and Haiti. He did that on the first day in office. That's one of the quite literally tens, approaching 200 executive orders that he has issued in that time. Trump administration has not tried to revoke the status of 240 Ukrainians who are also protected on this, at least not yet. And so what happens in the wake of the president's decision? The migrants sue. And they argue, of course, that the termination of this humanitarian parole, some other related parole programs are contrary to law, that they're arbitrary and capricious. You've heard that phrase before. Again, that means that they're senseless. They were simply doing this without any directive sense of mission and purpose out there. A federal judge in Massachusetts pauses, stops, and joins the administration's revocation of the program way back in March and found that Homeland Security and Kristi Noem lacked the authority to categorically revoke parole for all 532,000 people without providing an individual case-by-case review. And what does the court say? If these applications are coming in case-by-case, you've got to revoke them, if at all, looking back at the applications on a case-by-case basis. In early May, a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals from the First Circuit, they uphold the lower court's temporary block. They find that Ms. Noem, our secretary, had not made a strong showing that her categorical termination of humanitarian parole for all these migrants was likely to survive a court challenge. Emergency application goes to the Supreme Court May 8th. Our Solicitor General, we talk about him routinely. His name is John Sauer. He argues that Secretary Noem had, in his words, broad discretion over categories of immigration determinations, and that federal immigration law permitted the secretary to revoke that parole whenever its purposes had been served. By blocking the Trump administration from ending the programs, the lower court, he said, had needlessly upended critical immigration policies that are carefully calibrated to deter illegal entry, and had undone, according to your administration, your Department of Justice, had undone democratically approved policies that featured heavily in the election results. That coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week. When we come back, we'll move from immigration to academics into tariffs and injunctions once again in the second hour here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacy Lynn. Ukraine is calling it Operation Spiderweb, a large-scale attack carried out on military planes deep inside Russia. The BBC's Paul Adams with details.
The Ukrainians have published video evidence of a drone attack which has targeted the big heavy bombers that are used night after night to launch cruise missiles and other projectiles at Ukrainian cities.
The Ukrainian Security Service says the strike caused an estimated $7 billion worth of damage and comes as Russia fired hundreds of drones into Ukraine in its biggest hit since the war began. In Gaza, chaos as bodies were carried away of dozens of Palestinians killed near an aid center. CBS's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
There is controversy over what exactly happened.